Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch. My name's Windy, and I'm joined by my sidekick and best friend, Bardi. Hello, Bardi.
Hello, Windy.
And our tactics guy, and a man who loves Rocket League as much as Lucas Moura loves Tottenham Hotspur Football Club, Nathan A. Clark. Hello, Nathan.
Cars.
Nice. That was very nicely done. Quick work. How are you both doing?
I'm good. I would like to know where you learnt about Rocket League, Windy, because you don't strike me as the guy that knows about computer games.
I know about it because I see Nathan arranging games all the time. Like, it's just what he does now on our Discord. That's what he uses Discord for.
By popular demand, I'm not. You've made me out to be like the pusher of all of this, but it's, you know, it's a community activity, mate.
Nice. Okay. Yeah, you're community building. That's what you're doing. Cool. You well, Bardi?
I'm very, very well. Thank you very much, Windy.
Good. You Nath?
Yeah. I've had some interesting developments in my physio. Bit of pain over the last couple of days, but progress. So yeah, I'm not bad.
Nice. I'm well. My MacBook isn't. I just managed to spill a whole bottle of water over my MacBook on Friday night, and the trackpad has stopped working. So apologies for any clicking here. That is my magic mouse. We've had some lovely iTunes reviews. We asked people to leave iTunes reviews mentioning some of their most meaningful or memorable Spurs games. And we actually asked for titles of those reviews using which animals you would pick to defend you from the list we discussed in the last episode. So one of our reviews is happily titled 10,000 Rats, and there's a reference to Cole in the review, which is great. That's from A.L. Parnaby. Thank you for that. Bobby P90 talks about Wimbledon 2, Tottenham 6 from 1998, Jürgen Klinsmann, lovely stuff. And most recently, Kuss has sent a long review, which is a very enjoyable read, about Notts County Spurs from 1991. So if you go and look at our iTunes reviews, you'll be able to read all of those. They're very enjoyable. Thank you so much to everyone who's left one so far. Anyone else thinking about it, go for it. Do it. And remember to put in which animals would be protecting you also. We've had lots of Patreon content this week, most notably a video from Nathan on Zagreb.
Yeah, little Zagreb preview. I wanted to keep it short. It wasn't that short in the end. To be honest, and this really isn't selling the video that much, I don't think they're that interesting as a team, but got a little look at some of their players and where they're strong and where they're weak. Had a look at Ralf Hasenhüttl as part of the Good Manager series. We'll be moving on with that.
Can see Bardi turning his nose up.
I always enjoy when your replacements for Jose all end up in the mud, Windy, so I do enjoy that.
Yeah, you do. You take a lot of pleasure in anything I like not turning out to not be good, don't you?
Like a bit like fantasy football.
Oh my god, yeah, my fantasy team is not having a good time of it this week. And Bardi is smug because he captained Kane. He brought Kane in and made him captain, which is, to be fair, that's a pretty great bit of management, and you deserve plaudits for that. But
Steve Hitchin. Steve Hitchin style scouting there.
Yeah, but you actually like making transfers. He doesn't.
That's true. It's true.
Also, you take way more pleasure in my failure than your own success.
Yeah, that's a bit like my life. I enjoy Arsenal losing so much that sometimes when Tottenham win, it's like, okay, but Arsenal losing is brilliant. So maybe it says something about my personality.
Nathan, top level, Zagreb, what kind of team are they?
They're pretty malleable, as you would expect, as a team who are sort of the dominant force in their league. But then obviously when they come to play in Europe, they have to sort of adapt to the situation. So very briefly, they have some, I think, fairly skilled sort of attacking players. But mm-hmm. they don't, a little bit like Tottenham, but they don't have a great means of getting to them. And in their domestic league, a lot of the opposition teams just freely allow them to pass through to their attacking midfield and work it down the wing very easily. Whereas they will have a much harder time doing that against better teams. Obviously, they're going to play more sort of mid-block and counter against us, and they do have some threat on the counter because of those individuals. But again, I don't think that they are especially brilliantly well set up defensively or have a great means of setting up the traps for those counter-attacks.
Okay, so broadly speaking, you're not too worried about them.
I mean, that's the kind of thing that you say before you get knocked out of the Europa League by a team that you called, you know, bad.
Yeah, fair enough. Stay silent on that one. So Bardi, you mentioned being meh about Tottenham winning. I presume you were feeling pretty excited about the Palace result.
Yeah, of course. It was great. I'm very happy with Tottenham at the moment. Sometimes I'm in a bad mood with them, but today I'm in a good mood with them. I'm in a good mood with my manager and my team. We're scoring goals. We're scoring goals and we're scoring good goals as well. And defensively, we look a little bit better. But I guess we'll get into that as we examine the game in a bit more detail.
Yeah, I mean, there's not much to be cross about, to be honest, these past couple of weeks. I think you're completely justified in enjoying them. Team selection wise, Ndombele got a rest, a much needed rest, which was good. So Harry Winks came into midfield. Lucas was once again starting as a 10 or second striker, depending on how you see it. And Doherty got another start at right back. And Nathan, how are you feeling about the team selection? Did you think Winks was a good pick for this one?
Did I think Winks was a good pick for this one? I guess so. I thought it was kind of a strange one. So Alistair Gold sort of tweeted out a warning that there was going to be some peculiar team news. And then I thought off the back of that, there was a chance of like a really strong rotation and us like saving our best players for, again, a team who I've described as not great. Which was going to be curious. And then we have this sort of half rotation, which is literally something that we've been calling for. This is something that you and I say, we need to not have an A team and a B team. We need to play the AB and the BA, right? So we got that. But I just find that like Kane and Højbjerg as being like two non-rested players. I mean, I guess
Son
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, again, yes, good point. Mm-hmm. I guess Kane has got a couple of rests in, whereas, yeah, Son hasn't. I mean, obviously, like, we're not there on training. We're not monitoring energy levels. We don't have all of, like, the data we haven't seen. We haven't heard from them talking about any fatigue they might have. So we can't, from a distance, be like, this player's tired and this player isn't. So if Ndombele is the one who's tired and Aurea is the one who's tired, then fair enough. But it seems slightly odd based on who's played before. So it's a slightly strange rotation, I guess, sort of based on the expectations. But we're not surprised that rotation generally. Lucas is the 10. I mean, obviously, I'm hoping to see Dele again. And maybe he has to build fitness for a while before he can play twice in a week. I mean, you know my feelings about Lucas. He had a game that was more celebrated than most of his games. And I do think he had a really nice tackle on Milivojević for the first goal. But I, you know, Even what's considered a very good game for him, I still find him frustrating, to be honest.
I mean, Lucas had a exceptional Lucas game. If you're just looking in terms of what Lucas Moura does, he did what he does perfectly. He pressed, he ran with the ball, he took on players. But as a number 10, I think he had a pretty bad game because there was plenty of moments when Palace were behind the ball and it went to Lucas and it was a dead end. There was plenty of moments where towards the end of the first half especially, where the whole thing was just to keep the ball and not give it away. There's a couple of minutes to go and he did Lucas Moura things and lost the ball badly, and it wasn't his fault that we conceded a goal, but I think I'd partly blame him. Had that been Dele, I think Jose might have gone after him. But you know, he had a good game for Lucas Moura. He's not a number 10, but he does give us something interesting in that number 10. He does press, he does give us an option, but I don't think there should be anything more than a rotation.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I thought he had a pretty good game, if I'm honest. I mean, I sort of agree with both of you. He frustrates the hell out of me as well. But, I mean, if I just look at that game objectively, I don't think we'd have won without Lucas. I think he played a crucial role in securing the win. The tackle was one thing, but it wasn't just that tackle. He was essentially playing as an advanced destroyer. He ended up being involved in 23 duels in that game, which is eight higher than any other Spurs player, which is that's significant. He only won 39% of them, but that's not the point. I mean, he's attempting to, you don't have to necessarily win the duel to win the ball or win the position. So I feel like he had a strong game, and I don't mind this use of him where, he's just essentially using his athletic abilities to press opposition players, to duel with them, to try and win the ball high, to cause chaos in certain areas. It worked really well. I thought he was good.
I do think that things have been better since he moved into the number 10 role. Whenever I tweet out the lineup and I've put Lucas as the 10 and Bale out wide, to get several replies saying, shouldn't it be Bale as the 10 and Lucas out wide? But I don't know, I think that his sort of his chaos causing, as we've both sort of called it, is doing more damage and unsettling the opposition more in the middle. I think that there's perhaps a better chance to win the ball back immediately after he loses it in the middle. I think also he maybe sees the ball less in the middle, which isn't the worst thing, and sort of less isolated. So and then also, of course, his defensive work is going to matter more from that central position, literally winning the ball off their defensive midfielder and turning over there. So, yeah, I mean, a really good call from Mourinho to give this a run, and I think it's been pretty fruitful. Obviously, he still isn't my first choice as number 10, but I think it's a better use of him, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's like almost like Gareth Bale is a power washer, which is great if you know what you're going to do and what you're going to clean. But Lucas Moura is a garden sprinkler that is most effective when you put it right in the middle of the pitch, turn it on, it just goes prah, goes all over the place. Where Gareth Bale, you can use him more confined because he's very powerful but very direct. So yeah, Lucas Moura is probably best just allow him the freedom of the pitch and just to spray everybody though.
I love it. I mean, Bardi never fails to come up with an analogy for every situation. I had him more as like if Bale's the power washer on the patio trying to get the lichen off, Lucas is like there on his hands and knees scrubbing all day, and Bale just comes in and blasts it off with a karcher.
Yeah.
I'm not against Lucas performing that role. I'd obviously rather him not start every game, but in this particular scenario, it's difficult to argue that it wasn't highly successful.
I mean, we can now see that Dele will start against Zagreb and Lucas will start against Arsenal. That's set now.
Yeah, and so I'm not sure how I feel about that. I feel like he's a provocateur in a game like Palace. Against Arsenal, I'm not quite sure he'll have the same use. Perhaps we'll come back to that. Vidi Chopsticks asked, what changed in the second half? Were there any big tactical switches from Jose, or was it more just better energy from the lads? So what did you think, Nathan? What did the game look like to you?
Yeah, I wasn't too impressed with the first half, to be honest. I think there was a fair amount of a positive response from the fans over the first half. I wasn't that big on it. I think that so we did this thing, and it's a very Mourinho thing. It's stuff that something that we've done before. It's something that you saw a lot from his sort of 2015 Chelsea side, which is you've got your 4-2-3-1 shape, and you've got your four attackers in that, and they take it in turns to come join midfield, be the third midfielder, and then they turn with the ball, yep. and they either pick out a pass, or if you're Lucas Moura, you attempt to dribble the entire opposition team from that position. Sometimes it works out. And so that was being sort of, I don't know, mildly fruitful. It was a way of us getting the ball forward. It wasn't hugely effective. Obviously, we turned the ball over. Really good pressing from Lucas Moura. Really good tackle. The technique on the tackle, the sort of the blindsided tackle where Milivojevic couldn't see it coming. I really appreciate that from Lucas. That's sort of the thing that's got the most praise from me for Lucas Moura since he scored against Ajax. Yeah, really small turnover there. But otherwise, I didn't think that good. And then we started to sort of fade and let Palace have the ball and obviously conceded the equaliser. I don't know if there was a tactical shift at half-time. I definitely wouldn't rule it out. I think perhaps a minor one, it might be worth me going back and having a look for that. But I would definitely lean towards better energy. Jack Pitt-Brook suggested that because we conceded the equaliser just before the second half, we came out and we played the second half, whereas we may well have just tried to hang on to the 1-0. I'm not convinced by that, but I wouldn't rule it out either. But I think that over the last few weeks, we've seen, and I have to absolutely give Mourinho praise for this, we've seen more of a lean towards us maintaining possession over extended period of the entire game, to continue to attack for the entire game, to bring some, and I still don't think much, and Harry and I are gonna have it out in video form, I think, in the near future. I still don't think there's a huge amount of attacking planning going on, but there's some. There's a little bit, and there's the intention to continue to attack, and there's the intention to continue to possess the ball, and it's seeing results for us. It's not the most brilliant, most high intensity, most meticulous, most creative possession football, but it is kind of an impression of that, and it's effective.
Well, I'll tell you one of those bits of attacking planning. It's Gareth Bale, get yourself in the 6-yard box as much as possible.
Yeah, 100%.
And it's working. I mean, he had a really strong game, Bale, on the whole. But it's these crucial moments where he just knows where to be, knows what to do. His quality really shines through. I thought Kane's ball for the first goal was really, really good. Yeah. I mean, so it looks like a really straightforward pass. All he does is just cross it from the left to the right, whether it's a tap in. But he has to hit it really quite hard to make sure it gets there ahead of the defender and in front of the goalkeeper. And he weighted it absolutely perfectly and made it look like an easy delivery. It was not easy. Kane was absolutely, I mean, I'm literally running out of words to describe Kane. He was fantastic. 2 goals, 2 assists. The goal he scored from, a Matt Doherty fire assist, akin to Tom Carroll fire assist from many years back for Gareth Bale. It was delicious.
You know,
it was such a lovely finish.
It's the sensation of like when you know you've hit the ball well, when you know you've struck it well, and you think you've scored. For me, that goal is like the perfect encapsulation of like, yep, I've absolutely pinged this exactly where I want it to. Mm. It's such a perfect shot, and you can see how much he sort of had that planned seconds in advance. Just a strike that other players just do not hit, you know? Just so much power through the side foot, an absolute placement. Incredible. Yeah, he's absurd. He's just completely ridiculous.
It's also mad, like the different types of technique he has in his locker.
It's everything.
He can strike the ball with every part of his foot, except the knuckle, perhaps, which isn't so successful. But, you know, inside, outside, instep, toes, laces, he literally can strike a ball perfectly from every part of both feet.
He could have gone laces there. He could have gone outside weak foot. He could have chipped it far post as a pass. He could have dummied it to carry it and then tried to shoot low across the keeper. All of that is part of Kane's game. I was nearly going to say, and like that sort of a mark of his brilliance. I don't necessarily think that's true. I think that you can be an incredible player if you just do 2 or 3 things absurdly well. But honestly, he just does everything absurdly well. What an incredible player. On Bale, When he first was kind of come to us, we did a video and I sort of put forward to you the idea that he should be a centre forward, and maybe he doesn't want to be. He's against that idea. But I think we're seeing this thing where like he sort of becomes a centre forward in the final third. He's moving narrow a lot. He starts out on the right because I think that like he feels comfortable in that position and build up. He gets to touch the ball a couple of times, mm-hmm. which is good for confidence. Mm-hmm. He sort of feels at home in a wide area, but then in the final third, especially with Kane dropping off, of course, it's a bit like the Sun thing. I think with Sun is like Sun can take over the centre forward role when you're playing him behind early, when there's space for him to run into. But when there's defenders in the 6 yard box, that's not a great position for Sun. He's not physical enough. Whereas Bale is an athletic freak still at his ripe old age. Yeah, it's brilliant. It's really quite special to have him match fit. Again, I didn't think it was going to happen, but...
Yeah, I really didn't expect this. It's such a nice surprise.
That incredible excitement that we had at the beginning of the season, it was valid. And that's really sweet to know, you know?
I mean, even if it hasn't been validated in a football sense, it was still valid. But, sure. I mean, this is wonderful. It's really wonderful.
Would you take another year?
Bardi,
Would you take another year of Bale? Would you reloan him?
Would I reloan him? I don't think it's going to be an option. From the reports I read at the weekend, they don't want to consider another loan. They would only sell.
Okay.
And I would...
Ooh.
I think I would pay up to 18 million for Gareth.
Okay, what about his wages, though, if he's on 650 a week?
I mean, that's mad. We can't afford that. We can't justify that. Give him 200, he'll be happy with
for
that.
For how many years are you putting a 30...
2 years.
Ooh, okay.
That's my cutoff. No more.
Okay, interesting.
That sounds like an expensive deal, but I mean, he does when he's like this, he completely elevates us. Yeah, and I think there is like, I think there's an aspect of him elevating other players
sure.
too. I really believe that. And Bardi, I want to give you some space to talk about your manager and what he's got right in this game and that this run really.
Well, I didn't butt in because I was nice to listen to you two guys say positive things about Tottenham. I know you are. I know that's a bit harsh on both of you, but you are positive when it's right to be positive. But you also don't let Jose get away with anything. I'm actually going to say that Hodgson played into our hands in that game. I thought had they not switched at half time and continued to make it stodgy and turgid, I think we might have struggled for that game. But by taking off Eze, who was a bit more defensive, a bit more able to get up and down the wing and protect and help out the fullback. Yeah, they allowed Doherty and they gave Bale loads of space. And Doherty had one of his strongest performances for a while. You could see what Zaha offers him, but sometimes... You know, sometimes one player is not the kind of, doesn't matter how good that player is, that one player can still destroy the kind of team balance. And I thought Hodgson really messed up there, and I'm very happy that he did. I think the Bale goal was sensational. Obviously, the Bale part was great, but what I really enjoyed was the build-up play to it. And I know this will go down as a low XG goal because of the distance and everything else, but it's almost like the build-up to it makes it a better chance than it actually is. It's not a deflection and the ball's popped out and Kane just whacked it. It's a move that we've constructed, that Bale's dropped in a few times. A lot of players have been involved. And then Bale cuts inside, Doherty goes out wide, pulls the ball back and boom, Kane does the rest of it. So I think that whole team deserves credit for that. Of course, Kane will get all the kudos for the finish, but I thought it was a lovely move, and there was just a lot of positive stuff about how we moved in that second half. The overlapping runs. I think Reguilón is a completely different animal to Ben Davies, and he makes us look a different team.
Yeah, it's true.
And if Doherty can get a little bit of form back, and with Reguilón on the left, I think top four is still on, and we're just a different team with Reguilón in it, and we can even get away with not having Tanguy, which is good, because get Winks some minutes, get some confidence back in him. I think he still remains a useful squad player, and that performance out there would have done him the world of good.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't think we'd struggle to create without Ndombele in this one. I must admit, I felt like Winks was a good pick. I thought Winks had a perfectly tidy game. He's not played a lot of football recently, so it's good for him to get some minutes under his belt. He was on course to have well over 100 passes had he stayed on for the whole match. So he was controlling our possession pretty well, partnered well with Højbjerg. Højbjerg, in my view, it really needs a rest. I'm glad that they've already confirmed that he'll be on the bench against Zagreb. He really, really, really needs a rest because he's gonna, we must keep him fit for the run-in. We absolutely must. And I feel like he must be highly susceptible to injuries right now. Things just went pretty well. Orange Spurs said, isn't this the best way for us to defend on the front foot? And I wanted to talk to you both about our defending, which for the most part wasn't an issue against Palace. But we should probably talk about the goal in some detail. But what do you think, Nathan? Is this the best way for us to defend?
Yes.
Yeah, I agree. I completely agree. I think we've been saying for some time that, you know, if you reduce the number of defensive interactions that our players need to make, then you reduce the number of mistakes they'll end up making. And we don't have an immaculate back four, so that makes sense. Having said that, we were also pushing for the inclusion of Toby Adderall for quite some time.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, physically, he's a diminished force. I think if you're Bale, then you're a diminished force. You can still be an incredible attacker. But I think if your legs are going as a centre back, you can't turn as fast. It really undermines your game. I tweeted back and forth with Harry B a bit on that goal that we conceded, to try and provoke some discussion. We agree that Davinson Sanchez is first and foremost a mistake because he sort of is too early and too deep to the near post. But I do think at that point, the players behind him who can see the situation but need to accept sort of Davinson's mistake and Alderweireld need to get across to Benteke earlier. Obviously, like, if Benteke has a run on Alderweireld, he's going to win 9 times out of 10. So it's a difficult one for him. And yeah, Davinson is too early, lets Benteke drift off him, gets too far over to the near post when there's no one threatening there. In fact, it starts before that with Doherty. He moves up to press sort of into midfield, and then he sort of realizes that phase is over, scampers back into position, but he does so with his hips and his chest facing the corner flag and his head turned round to his right across his defence. So he's sort of twisted back around. The ball goes back out into his wide area and he has to turn all the way around to see it. By the time he does, I can't remember who the crosser is, but the Palace player already has a second on the ball. So he can sort of jog out there and try to block half the angle, but he's slow out there, allows the cross. Mm-hmm. And then Davinson is too early, too eager, too deep for the near post and leaves Alderweireld with two players to mark.
I mean, I get what you're saying, but I still think even Davinson with a stepladder, he would have had a job to kind of stop that. I think it was a good cross and it was a good header. I think they could have perhaps done something to affect Benteke's jump. Like, he allowing him to jump unchallenged was a mess. But I'd still pin the blame a bit more on Toby than Davinson.
Really?
But I think so. Toby can see the game. I think he needs to at least challenge Benteke. He can see the ball. He can see everything happening in front of him.
I hadn't even considered that it might have been Toby at fault there. For me, that goal was mainly on Sanchez. There's a bit of Doherty, as Nathan points out. I don't know if Nathan mentioned this, but it's the misjudging of the flight of Townsend's pass as well that I thought caused the initial problem. So Townsend plays this crossfield pass. Sanchez just completely misjudges the flight of the ball and so leaves Doherty up against Benteke aerially, which is slightly problematic. He could have gone up and won that ball, I thought, or at least challenged for it. And Bale's tucked in narrow because that's how he'd been asked to defend. So Van Aanholt was out wide free and suddenly Milivojevic became the spare man and he was the eventual crosser.
Oh, yeah.
And then I thought Sanchez initially had taken up a reasonable position in the middle. He had Benteke. Alderweireld had Ayew. Sanchez had Benteke. But then he just seems to stop following his man, ball watches for a couple of seconds. And before you know it, Benteke's created a big gap and he's essentially in a 2v1 against Alderweireld. He's left with Ayew as well. It wasn't impressive from Sanchez. But, I mean, the point being that it didn't matter and then some, because once we scored a second, we then didn't stop scoring. And we can afford, when you score four goals, you can afford a couple of errors of judgment like that. It's far less of a problem.
This is definitely it. Like, we won't be the first or last team to concede a shot that is a cross into the, you know, 7 meter tall Christian Benteke, yeah. You know? And if we'd spent the rest of the game defending our box, there was probably another mistake in us for that kind of goal. But we opted to to possess and attack, and it does wonders for us.
Absolutely. Just a shout out to Russ Green, who asked us a question which we've basically answered already, but I just wanted to thank him for that. Fulham game, we already spoke about in some detail on the Q&A pod that we released on the main podcast feed. So we do these Q&A podcasts for the ex-subs. That was our 10th one. They're a bit more informal, a bit more chatty. This time Bardi did a quiz, which was really fun, but really chaotic. And yeah, not sure if we'll repeat it in the same format again, but it was funny. But yeah, we covered the Fulham match in the first half of that podcast. So go back and listen if you want our thoughts on that game. Anything left to say about the Palace match, or should we move on to questions?
No, I got nothing else to add. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was a Tottenham match that it was a Premier League game. I've enjoyed plenty of Europa League games, but it was a Premier League match I really enjoyed, and that's a good sign.
And I guess I'd like to just add that whilst I don't think that certainly Palace and Burnley are strong teams, I think Fulham are a better team than their league position suggests. But whilst I don't think any of them in theory are teams that should cause us problems, I had major doubts a few weeks back about our ability to beat these teams. Major doubts. I thought we might get 3 or 4 points from these three matches. So that is major progress. That is a huge amount of progress in a short space of time. And things are certainly looking up at the moment, and I'm not gonna pretend that I'm unhappy with the way things are going. This is good. Things are moving in a forward direction. This is good stuff. If we continue playing this way and getting results, there's nothing to complain about.
I mean, Palace dodged up Manchester United midweek. Fulham beat Liverpool away. Burnley held Arsenal. They are bad football teams, but they are pretty stodgy, pretty turgid to get through. And we battered two of them away. Fulham gave us a little bit more trouble, but we still got a job done. So yeah, I think it's really positive.
I'll piss on everyone's cornflakes now that we're this far in. So. I've given Mourinho props for his approach to over those last few games. I think he's recognised the issue with our sort of low block counter game. He's coached us in the right direction. I think that we are a better team than we were a few weeks ago. I think we have an okay shot at taking fourth place. But I'd already sort of, and there are a lot of people who won't want to hear this, but I think there'll also be people who sort of feel similarly. I've already gone past the point of caring, and we won 4-1, and it didn't make me that happy. And I think that's a really, really sad place to be as a Spurs fan. It's not, again, it's not somewhere I've really been before. I think that Mourinho has done a good job arresting the negative form and has maybe turned us into maybe just currently shy of a top four side. For me, that's still not worth it. I still think there's great potential in the squad, and also the squad plus whatever the summer budget might be. I would still be looking to change up the manager in the summer, especially if the opportunity for Nagelsmann presents itself or something other than that, similar to that. So I have to praise Mourinho and say that he's done a good job over the last few weeks, identified the issue, been pragmatic and changed up his style. But I'm not on board. He hasn't won me round. Yeah, I'm not happy.
Oh God. Yeah. You know? Yeah. No, I'm with you, mate. I'm with you all the way. And the thing is, I feel like I'm in a bulletproof position at the moment, because either we're winning games and doing better in them, and that's why Mourinho stays, and that's fine, because I'd like to see us playing nice football, winning games, or Mourinho goes. So I'm like, fine, you know, let it play out and just whatever happens,
sure.
Happens.
Yeah, yeah.
And in the meantime, maybe we do sort of get ourselves back into some form, ready for the cup final, or to maybe we do continue getting these really nice draws in the Europa League, and we get to the final and he can get that one over the line. Yeah. That'll be a lovely bonus. Bardi, you're ominously quiet throughout.
No, I'm just listening in. I mean, it's quite an easy stance to take, Windy. You can say I'm very happy if we win, but I'm very happy if we lose. It doesn't, you know, it's anybody could say that, and of course. But you know, I'm happy we're winning. I'm happy we're playing nice football, and I'm happy listening to you, Windy, talk about Jose in a positive light. So it's I'm winning as well. We're both winning.
It's win win win.
Win-win-win.
Except poor Nathan over there, who's just fed up.
Nathan, I'm so worried about you, man. Don't worry. But it's just enjoy the wins. You can enjoy the win. Come on.
Let's go on to some questions. We have a lot to get through. So Ribble on Discord says, would Mourinho still be here if Arsenal were having a good season?
I think maybe we sort of done the other half of this as well. Like, if Arsenal were having a good season and the fans were in the stadium, I think things would have got really, really pretty toxic. But without either of those things, I think one without the other maybe isn't enough. Both of those together, maybe that plays a little bit of a role.
I think had Arsenal had a good season with a young progressive manager apparently and everything else, then Mourinho might have been under pressure. But no, you know, Mourinho's eating Arteta for breakfast again.
I'm not going to be too smug about that just yet, because if they do beat us...
They're 7 points behind us right now.
Yeah, if they beat us, it's suddenly 4 points, and it wouldn't surprise me massively if they overtook us. So I'm going to keep my ink dry on that one. I think I agree with Nathan that if the fans were in the stadium, Mourinho might have gone by now. I think that's where I stand on that. Emperor K says, do you think Liverpool's mixed overall form and setup this season with a weakened defence and strong attacking line is similar to Spurs, hence our similar league positions? If so, though we might lack a playmaker and our manager is controversial, are we only a centre-back or two away from becoming a real force? I guess this comes down to the... do you just need world-class players to be a good team, or can you get a good team from some good world-class players and some average players? But what do you think, Bardi?
I mean, I think Liverpool's problems at the moment is their centre midfield is a mess, and that's perhaps affected by the fact that Fabinho needs to play at centre back, and when Henderson's been having to play there. So, but then also Salah and Mane are incredible players. Firmino's okay, but it takes a very special individual to be able to maintain those kind of numbers over 4, 5, 6 seasons. The ones that do it are, you know, Messi, Ronaldo, who are freaks of football, and you don't see those kind of people again. So it's very difficult to ask Liverpool to be able to continue to do this. Losing Diego Jota hurt them, but I just think it's just a natural drop off of a team that was working at 99% of capability, that eventually they're going to drop off a little bit. And, you know, I think that's really what's happened to them. They just need a little bit of a break and a little bit of a change here and there. But I don't think anything's down to Van Dijk, to be honest.
I just think their numbers of injuries have been absurd. And I don't think that's bad luck, to be honest. I think that is partly the system they've tried to play, partly whatever it was they were doing last season, and partly the footballing schedule. And it's taken its toll hugely. I mean, the injuries have just torn through every part of their team. The only players that seem to have survived this are Salah, Mane, Alexander-Arnold and Robertson. Everyone else seems to have had some sort of injury breakdown at some point. But yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say they're unlucky with that, because I think it's partly as a result of their style of play and their training methods and everything else. Nathan, what do you think?
I do think that they are having an awful, awful time with injuries this season. I do think that Van Dijk specifically undermines their defence, their midfield and their attack. I also think that if they had been taking performance-enhancing drugs for the last 3 years, now would be a good time to cycle off. And I do think that they've played a hell of a lot of games this season, as we all have. We've all played far too many, and their style of football... high intensity football is so undermined by the lack of pre-season, the too many games at once, the length of the season, everything else. Mm-hmm. But I also suspect, and Andrew Gaffney tweeted this as well, that like they might kind of be getting towards the point that we were at last season, which is simply that the same bunch of players have been under the same manager for so long, and things are just sort of a bit mentally fatigued, and they need some kind of refreshment.
Painful rebuild.
They might need maybe not the big overarching, but they kind of need to do, I think, what they did with Coutinho. They need to sell a star. They need to sell Salah, and bring in some young midfielders. Maybe sell one of their fullbacks, and just sort of move things around a little bit, or change their manager out and hope that someone else will reignite the same squad. You know, tough call either way, I guess.
They could really do with Jose Mourinho, couldn't they? I just feel like he would eke the last remnants from that squad. Definitely not Nagelsmann.
Jose, I think Jose would do a great job at Liverpool. I think he might win the double.
Jesus. So Adam, THFC14, says, if Liverpool were to sack Klopp and appoint Nagelsmann, would Klopp be a realistic and good option for Spurs?
I mean, Klopp is a top-tier manager. He's one of the best managers in the game, so I think hiring Klopp wouldn't be a bad thing. It would be awful to see, but I'd get behind it.
He's a bell end, but he's not as much of a bell end as our current manager, so he'd be a bit more tolerable.
I think he's probably as close to being a bell end. I think he's very close to being a bell end, like compared to Mourinho. I think he gets away with a lot of stuff because he says it with a happy, happy smile. But I think he's a
that is true. That is really true. He's a cheerful bell end.
Mourinho's a bit more Latin and a bit more surly, whereas Klopp has digged out reporters just as many times as Jose has.
He can be really spiteful with the press.
Yeah.
I don't think he treats players as badly as Mourinho does. But I mean, you're right. He's a top class manager. I'm sure Daniel Levy has that noted in his little book. I feel like Klopp would need to take a break from football. He doesn't look great at the moment. He looks kind of how Pochettino did after the end of his Spurs stint. He just needs to step away for a few months and refresh and spend some time on the beach. So I'm not sure that would work out timings wise, to be honest. Nathan, would you take Klopp?
Yeah, but it's a bit of a weird one. It doesn't feel appropriate, does it, for him or for us? Obviously, he's a brilliant manager. While I've been looking at Hasenhüttl, I've been looking into sort of Klopp, and I think there's quite an extent to which it's more his team than him specifically, and he's the face of a changing coaching team. Obviously, that's the case for every manager, but more so for him. And that Buvac and Linders are sort of the what we would more traditionally think of as the managers at Liverpool.
Oh, interesting. Okay, yeah, I hadn't realised that at all. Okay, let's move on to the next one, which is from SB Walker. Everyone's thoughts on Joachim Andersen versus Ezri Konsa. I mean, I said in the Fulham pod, section of the Q&A pod, I really like Andersen. I think he's a good defender, very talented defender, but more than that, he's a ball-playing defender. He's a passer. He's a line-breaking passer. He can carry the ball into midfield. He's competent in possession. I don't think he's an ideal Mourinho defender, but I think he, you know, if we're looking beyond Mourinho, I think he's absolutely perfect for a manager who wants to play out from the back and now has obviously a year of Premier League experience, so I'm all for that. Equally, Konsa's had a very strong season, definitely less talented on the ball, to the extent where I'm not sure how good he is on the ball. He's a bit nervous, actually, but very, very good defensively, very strong performances for Aston Villa. I don't think he's the kind of top-tier centre-back that we should be in for. I feel like he's on the same tier as many of our other centre-backs, if I'm completely honest. He will probably be a slight upgrade on Sanchez or Dier, and arguably Tanganga, although I still think Tanganga's got lots to offer if he's given a proper run. But what do you think, Nathan? Do either of these players interest you?
Don't have a huge amount of thoughts on Konsa, but Andersen we were linked to back when he was at Sampdoria, and I had a look at him then, and I was really excited by him. And seeing him in the Premier League has done sort of no harm to that. Yeah, he's still only 24, young for a centre-back. He is currently owned by Lyon. Yes. So things might be a bit tricky. I don't know what plans they do and don't have for him. But yeah, I think he's good. I like him.
Vardy, any thoughts?
Looks good. Passes the ball nicely, but he's going to cost an awful lot of money. But yeah, I like him.
I mean, they would be very sensible to sell high after his performances for Fulham, wouldn't they, Lyon? It would make a lot of sense.
Lyon are the worst team to try and buy from as well.
No, we are.
No one. Well, yeah. Yeah. Spurs and Lyon trying to do a deal. It's just like, it's got to be the worst time for an agent.
Negative Dialectics says, if Skip continues to develop, best case scenario, what current/previous player will he most resemble? Good question. Scott Parker?
Yeah, I think that's a really good shout.
From a Spurs perspective?
Yeah, that's right.
I say that from two perspectives. One, that he's very tenacious and quick into the tackle like Parker was, despite not being like physically massively imposing. He's quick off the mark and he wins the ball well. He's got a good mentality in that respect. But also, he has other skills as well. He can carry the ball forward and he's got a longer range of passing than he lets on, but he just doesn't do it very often. So he sort of plays in a slightly restricted way. So that's why he reminds me of Scott Parker.
Yeah.
But I watched Harrison Reed play for Fulham against us the other day, who I thought was really good, and I just was thinking the whole time, Skip does all this stuff as well, and it'll be really handy to have him in the squad next year.
Skip is obviously doing very, very well at Norwich, receiving huge amounts of plaudits that we are exposed to every single game by Norwich fans. They're really adoring him. And this is a club who have, you know, Buendia on the books still. He gets man of the match too often because they put it onto a Twitter poll and then the Spurs fan base as a whole jump on it, and then it sort of mixes up their own perception because they voted him man of the match, therefore he must have been man of the match anyway. Whatever, that's beside the point. He's obviously doing very well. We had a look at him, when was that, back in December? Before that, maybe, even? And maybe we could do that again. But
I wasn't expecting a but.
His defensive numbers still aren't
right.
The most incredible.
Okay. Is that not because Norwich is such a dominant team, though?
I don't think so, to be honest. I don't think so. I think the thing is that, like, he was playing so well, defending so smartly. again, obviously, he is very tenacious, that I was thinking maybe by the end of the season, the numbers will sort of even themselves out and he will show up more as someone who's getting up towards three tackles, getting up towards three interceptions. They're still just sitting a little bit low. And I think that I don't know. Maybe it's something to think about more in the context of Norwich. But that's my only concern at the moment, is that he's a little light on defensive numbers. Everything else, I'm very, very happy with.
And he does your favourite thing, which is a tackle or an interception, which is also a pass.
If he could mix it up with a couple of tackles and interceptions that maybe aren't even passes, once or twice more a game, I'll be ecstatic.
Cool. And I mean, that is a reasonable thing to expect as he develops and gets older. You know, what he's doing at the moment for such a young player is mightily impressive. We should be very, very excited about Skip. In fact, let me just say at this point, we should be very, very excited about our young players generally, because we have some of the best young talent in the country at the moment. So I watched on Saturday morning our under-18s destroy Chelsea, absolutely destroy them. Mathurin scored a hat-trick, Scarlett scored a couple. We were really, really impressive across the pitch. The two midfielders, who are twins, Michael and Matthew Craig, were fantastic. Alfie Devine just glided about the pitch, doing whatever he wanted, taking the piss out of Chelsea a lot of time. He's far too good for that level. In Devine and Scarlett, we have two of the best teenagers in the country, in my view. I think we are exceptionally well set to have a productive academy in the next few years, and I'm very excited about that.
Do you have any extended thoughts on the hat-trick score on Mathurin?
He is... he's a very exciting talent. He's incredibly technically gifted. His level of skill in a one-on-one situation is like elite level exciting skill, and in this game, my word, did he apply himself. The free kick he scored was delightful. His third goal was, he took a slightly poor first touch, an absolutely magical second touch, and then a really good finish. This one is from Shafe, who says, "This may seem like a relatively minor thing, but our defenders still frequently put their arms behind their backs in the box. But doesn't the softening of the rule that happened after the first few weeks of the season make this largely unnecessary?"
Until they change it again, and until that's not the case. The thing is that, like, they've learned, they've self-coached, or even been actively coached to do that. So maybe the next generation of defenders don't feel the need to do that. But again, until they change the rules again, so who knows? So you again, like, the point I'm trying to make here is that, like, it takes time to react to the rules, and if the rules are changing, like, literally, we didn't concede that goal to Fulham because of an accidental handball, and then, like, the day after they announced that won't be the case next season or something. I don't know. So you can't keep up with it. You can't train to it. So you have to play on the worst case scenario for everything.
I loved how they then said, oh, this has been planned since October, we're just announcing it now. As if, like, that fax wasn't at the bottom of the pile and someone just went, oh, God, there's been a terrible decision. You remember that fax I sent 4 months ago? Get that one to the top of the pile for the intern to work on. Ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. But, I mean, I agree. I think it is a training thing. It's a coaching thing. They've been coached to keep their hands behind their back for all the right reasons. It's a sensible strategy. Mm-hmm. And it will hinder their movement, but at the time, it's felt that that was the better of the situations, better of the scenarios. And I think until Nathan says we have complete clarity on the handball rule, I think that is the right thing to continue to do, because who knows if it will switch back at some point.
Yeah, I mean, our defenders are big stiff idiots most of the time. So any action that they take on the pitch that reduces the possibility of them giving away a penalty, I'm all for. So if it's keeping their hands by their side, then please keep doing that.
THFC Kalamazoo says, we have used two wildly different approaches or tactical setups. Recently, we've been mostly successful with a higher press and a higher line, less defensive, more attacking. Should we pivot back to a low block, which was massively effective against the likes of the Arsenal City? You've lost points for calling them the Arsenal, Kalamazoo, I'm afraid.
That's actually my fault. He actually wrote the scum, but I changed. I just got rid of scum and put Arsenal.
Then I retract my previous comments. You do not lose any points, Bardi. You lose 10 points.
Sorry.
What do you think against Arsenal? Low block?
It's something I was...
I mean, I assumed we would play low block against Arsenal, to be honest.
Yes, but I think that... So I talked like back earlier in back in November, we were running a sort of an interesting defensive setup where our central midfielders become our channel defenders and our fullbacks defend wide. I call it the 4+2. And it was really interesting. It's quite different and it was effective. And what I said was, we are also, every time we use it, we're showing our hand. And I think that gradually teams sort of came prepared with plans of how to flatten us out and then play back to the central midfielder and then play through. The point being that, like, the more time we spend defending deep, the more time we have to keep coming up with fresh, new, inventive ways to defend deep. I think that now that we are, now that we're spending a lot more time with the ball, we can also plan and keep our cards to ourselves about how we're going to defend deep when we defend deep. So we need very specific defensive setups that we're going to use against Arsenal and City, and then only use them against Arsenal and City. And that's difficult to train for, to only put something into practice in the match itself, having not been able to prepare it in a previous match. Maybe you'll see us defend deep for the last 10 minutes completely unnecessarily against Dynamo Zagreb just to get that practice in, you know. But I think that generally is the way forward.
Okay. Any thoughts, Bardi?
I think we'll switch between the two. I think we will go to low block for periods of the game and then other points we'll push them. I think we're a little bit more fluid now than we were at the start of the season. I still think against Arsenal, sometimes the best form, the best way to attack them is to allow them to come onto you and then just bang them over the top. So I think we'll probably start with that. But I think Burnley showed that if you press Arsenal, they're also quite capable of shooting themselves in the foot. So it's weird. I think we'll do a little bit of both. And that's why I think Lucas will start, because he'll help us in that press. But I do think, I think Arteta should be concerned with Bale, but I don't think he'll do anything to stop Bale, which I think will play into our hands. Because he's like that. He has his philosophy. This is how we play. And like we saw earlier in the season, they knew how we were going to set up and they just walked into it because they refused to adjust. And I think his rigid approach to the game will allow Jose to be able to flick between the two and ultimately beat him.
I wouldn't be at all surprised if we see a Sissoko QBA midfield against Arsenal with Ndombele playing in the 10.
I hope not. I don't think we'll see that. I think Sissoko's time is now coming to an end as a starting player in proper football matches.
Well, Ndombele's shown that he's more than capable of playing in a two-man midfield. Mm-hmm. And in fairness, we were right about that as well. We said that from the start of the season that we wanted to see Ndombele play in a two-man midfield, and he has proven that he's more than capable. He's an exceptional player. I mean, to be honest, we should just devote 2 minutes of every podcast just talking about what a player Tongi Ndombele is, because he's magnificent and I absolutely adore watching him play. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if he does play 10 against Arsenal and we go with Bale right, Son left, Ndombele centre. Speaking of our attacking lineup, Fridges on Fire says, does Basque have the right balance? The Fulham game has shown the willingness to press from the front line, but without Lucas in the mix, we have absolutely no pace for the defence to worry about. Delhi is about movement off the ball. When we play against a team that wants to play football and we don't have the majority of possessions, it doesn't work. Firstly, I want to push back against Basque because...
His name's Delhi.
He doesn't like Ali being used. He's actively said that he doesn't want to use the name Ali, so we should respect his wishes and not refer to him as Delhi Ali. It's Delhi. But BDSK sounds far too... like BDSM, so someone needs to do some work on finding
There's no vowel, there's no acronym. You have to let the acronyms go. Mm. It's just our attack.
Yes. Okay, Nathan, fine. Why do you hate fun?
Because there's no vowel. This is just not going to happen.
So go back to the question from Fidges on Fire. Bardi, what do you think? Is there a lack of pace in Bale, Delhi, Son and Kane?
Son is fast enough, and I sometimes think smartness of mind is faster mm-hmm. than smartness of body. There's an awful scene in the film Goal, and I don't know if you remember it, where the guy who's meant to be Arsene Wenger makes Santiago Munoz run the end of the pitch, but he kicks the ball there, and then he makes him do it 10 times, and eventually Santiago's like, oh, okay, and he goes, you see, it's always quicker, the ball moves quicker than the person. And I think what Delhi does give us is he gives us a smartness of attacking play like Eriksen did, and smartness of mind will always be smart, faster than body, unless it's a 100-meter race or something.
Just to add to that also, that Delhi is one of the best timers of a run in the league, and that can make up for a lack of flat-out pace as well, because if you beat the defender to the run, you quite often make it through ahead of them. So I'm not worried about it personally. Nathan, any concerns from you?
No, and Delhi is also a phenomenal presser of the ball too. Basically, yes. anything that Lucas can do, Delhi can do better.
Yeah.
Maybe not right now. Maybe not right this second with the fitness issues and coming back into form, and the fact that Lucas is really out there doing it right now and playing his best football. I accept that. But at their best, and I do think that it's very much possible for us to get Delhi to his best, he's better in every single department. He's going to put up fewer dribbles as a total than Lucas, but he's going to be more effective with when and where and how and what he does after the dribble than Lucas is. And as a result, he's a better player. He's probably weaker in the air despite the massive height advantage. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Yeah, I agree. And to be honest, I'm thinking back now to earlier in the season where Kane was playing lots of balls for the onrushing Son. I mean, that move was heralded for being incredibly quick and difficult to stop because it was so quick. Mm. So I don't think we need to worry. And we've got Reguilon back now. He adds another dynamic, a pacey dynamic to our attack too, coming from deep. Dan Alvarez says, after a slow start, it seems like Cameron Carter-Vickers is back to his normal thing of looking really good in the Championship, yet he never seems to be considered as a potential first-teamer. He's younger than Roden, who we also signed after being really good in the Championship, and seems to be a pretty good fit for a team that defends deep. From what I gather, people don't feel like he's a good enough passer to play in a progressive system. But considering we don't really play that way anymore, what stops him from being a first-team consideration? Can't say I've seen much of him, but would love your insight on his situation. And I have to say that Dan has summarised Carter-Vickers' style there really well. He's a very good deep block defender who is exceptionally good at defending the penalty area, and his weakness is passing out from the back. So, yeah, what do you think, Nathan?
Yeah, sure. that was always my issue with Carter-Vickers. If he's proving himself a very strong box defender, at senior level, at Championship level, then yeah, I guess that he should have some consideration for us. I just like the thing is that like what we've been talking about this episode is like us moving away from us playing sort of archetypal Mourinho ball and him adapting and him playing with more possession, with a higher line, with more space behind, more front footedness. So I guess that he at this point he sort of still he can present himself as sort of like a useful squad option. He can be I guess sort of a Davinson Sanchez alternative, but medium term, long term, definitely, he's still not going to be what we're looking for.
I think also if Mourinho thinks Tanganga is too short at centre back, then Carter Vickers is shorter still. I think Carter Vickers will leave at the end of the season. I think his contract's due to expire. We'll get compensation, but that'll be it. And everyone will say, wasn't this a waste? But yeah, I mean, good luck to him. I think he would do really well in a team like Burnley who defend deep. I think he would be more than adequate for a team like Burnley or even Crystal Palace, someone like that. Final question. We've done a lot of questions, haven't we? We've really caught up on our questions. Matt Pants says, okay, my soy boys, here's the question. Please explain Giovanni Lo Celso to me. The extra inch shtick is all about evidence-based takes rather than opinions and feelings. So you need to explain why you think Gio is a really good player and is in Nathan's starting 11 conversation. As you rightly point out, he doesn't do goals or assists. One goal, three assists in 39 games. And he's not in the team for his defensive skills, which the stats say he's markedly poorer than Winks, Huibier, and Ndombele or Sissoko. So what does he do? Is it just the assist to the assist? Even in that capacity, his numbers are about one key pass a game, which is decent, but not a whole lot better than, say, Lamela or Moura. I know stats aren't the be-all and end-all, but his are pretty damning. So on what basis do you rate him so highly? So I plugged his name into FB Ref, which now Football Slices has gone, is a really good website to get a snapshot of a player and tells you which percentile they're in for various attributes. And basically, if you look at him against other midfielders, there's a lot of green bars, which mean he comes out very, very, very well to the point where he's like in the 97th percentile for various categories. Non-penalty expected goals, non-penalty expected goals, expected assists. Where are we? Dribbles completed. These are, he's amongst the best in the, I guess, top five leagues, Nathan?
So this is comparing him to other midfielders over the course of the last year. And in the last year, he's almost exclusively played attacking midfield. So I think that he's always going to have very impressive attacking numbers compared to other midfielders. But if you look at his attacking midfield and winger template, let's have a look. So 69th percentile for expected assists. So the assists aren't coming through, but the passes to create are. And if he's only putting up one key pass, then it's a very strong key pass to a really good location. 74th percentile, putting up 3.9 shot creating actions. So that key pass statistic you've read is wrong. It's 3.8. That's going to include like shots off dribbles and shots for himself, but still, high number of passes, good number of passes completed, progressive passes, 93rd percentile with 5.1. And that really shows that to me is sort of the unsurprising, standout feature of his game is his ability to progress the ball. And at the moment, you can see how important that would be to us and how much that would mean to us. Just being a creative midfielder who was able to access attacking midfielders, access Kane, make things happen for that, make us a lot less reliant on attackers taking it in terms of dropping to midfield. And if he's the attacker doing that, he'd be, you know, as good as Kane at doing that and allow Kane to be in the box a little more often. 99th percentile for pressures, 99th percentile for tackles. This is compared to attacking midfielders rather than compared to defensive midfielders who that's more of their game. 80th percentile for blocks, 68th percentile for clearances, 76th percentile for aerials. He's a phenomenal player. And if we didn't have this loaded up here, I'd be very confident telling you that anyway, because I think it really shows on the eye test. He's a brilliant, brilliant creative midfielder. And that doesn't necessarily immediately mean assists right from the off, but his ability to progress the ball into attacking areas and have it arrive in a good manner, have it arrive at the feet of other players. Comfort carrying the ball. He's really strong in his ability to mix up his carrying and his passing as well. So he's hard to sort of defend, come with a plan to defend against because he can mix it up in that way. He's as good as, you know, the likes of Ndombele and Kane at moving the ball from one of the pitch to the other, which is by far the most underrated aspect of all of football.
And, I mean, from what you were just saying about Dele being able to do everything Lucas does and then do it better, these numbers show that Lo Celso is absolutely the same. You know, the pressures and tackles, 99th percentile, that's That's extraordinary. That's really impressive. If you put the Celso into the role Lucas has been designated in the last few games, he's going to do that. But then also there's going to be output. There's going to be shot creating actions at the end of it. So yeah, huge upside. I mean, I really want to see Lo Celso in a midfield three with Ndombele and Huibier. I think that would be really exciting. But I'd also equally be happy to see him as a 10 or on the right of our attacking band. I'm really excited to have him back, actually. Yeah, I mean, it's perfect timing with the schedule we have coming up that he's returning to the fold.
I would be interested to hear back from Matt in a few weeks' time after Lo Celso's had a run of games.
Lots of people are very down on him. I think it's partly the injury record, and I think that is completely justifiable as a position. It is very disappointing how little we've actually had him on the pitch since we signed him. But also, I think, you know, when you sign an Argentinian, attacking midfielder, then you are going to expect goals and assists. He's just not that kind of player, right?
Certainly not goals. I think he's been a little unlucky on his return of assists, and I think that we will see if he's fit next season. We'll see a nice little bunch of assists, most likely.
And Bardi, obviously, you're not a true soy boy. You're an oat boy. but what do you think? Where do you stand on the Celso?
I think his biggest weakness right now is his fitness, and I think the impression I get is he's not being rushed back this time because we're not in desperate need for him to come back immediately. So hopefully he'll be managed a bit better, and I have big hopes for him. I think as if you just remove Sissoko and you have your midfield options are Højbjerg, Winks, Lo Celso, Dele, Ndombele, all of a sudden that's a very strong kind of midfield group, and Lo Celso, you know, the numbers speak for himself. He's a very, very good player and he just needs to get fit.
Absolutely. Nathan, I did watch the Soy Boy videos that you linked. We put them in the show notes of that episode. The takedowns of Paul Joseph Watson were breathtakingly good. I strongly recommend those videos. Highly, highly enjoyable. Cheers, boys. Nice to talk about a Spurs win. Let's hope we're talking about a Spurs win after the North London Derby.
Peace.
You've been listening to The Extra Inch. Thanks to Nathan A. Clark for production. Thanks to Bardi for being Italian. Thanks to Adam Gardner for the artwork. Thanks to David Lindmer for our intro music. You can find him on Twitter at Davey Shambles and his SoundCloud, E. Lindmer. Do check him out, he's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us via podcast@theextrainch.co.uk and subscribe via your usual podcast platforms. And if you do enjoy the podcast, consider leaving us a rating and review. That would really help.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.